Welcome to Guerrilla Radio on CFUV 101.9 FM. And, you know, we're heard at cfuv.uvic.ca on the internet, everywhere else. The plans have been in the works for a while, and last week, Island Timberlands prepared to begin clear-cut logging, within the ancient forests of Cortez Island. Locals, organized through Wild Stands, a Cortez Island community alliance, were ready. Forest access roads were blockaded, legal threats then made by the company, and everything was looking like a war in the woods, in the making. Well, that was last week. In the interim few days, Island Timberlands has withdrawn its clause somewhat, assuring locals its promised application for an injunction will be delayed for at least this week, while some form of negotiation can commence. It's not the end of the fight, or even the beginning of the end, but it is the end of the beginning. Sorry about that, Winnie. Zoe Miles is a Cortez Island-raised activist and spokesperson for Wild Stands, and she'll join us in the first half. And last week, the United Nations General Assembly, in a historic vote, ratified the Palestinian Authority's application for recognition by that body as a, quote, non-voting observer, non-member state. The motion was endorsed by an overwhelming majority, despite, or perhaps because of, weeks of bluster and bullying by Israel's representatives and those of its nearest friends in Canada and the United States. In unprecedented fashion, Stephen Harper's new government of Canada called back to Ottawa senior diplomats from Israel, the West Bank, and most pointedly from the UN missions in New York and Geneva. Reacting to domestic and international ridicule, Canada's Foreign Affairs Minister John Barrett assured Canada's diplomats will return to their posts following consultations on what future direction the country will take in dealing with the region. Jim Miles is a retired educator writing on politics, U.S. foreign policy, and the environment. His articles and book reviews are published online at the Palestine Chronicle and Pacific Free Press, amongst others. Miles covered the surprise Canadian government reaction to the UN move in the article, "Congratulations, Palestine, from an embarrassed Canadian." Jim Miles in the second half. And Victoria Street News publisher and CFUV radio broadcaster Janine Bancroft will join us at the bottom of the hour to bring us news from our city streets and beyond. But first, Zoe Miles and a Mexican standoff in the woods of Cortez Island. Stick around. Well, welcome to the program, Zoe.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, it's my pleasure, of course. Now Zoe, Island Timberlands says Cortez Islanders have a week's grace before having the court sicked upon them, perhaps. Has Island Timberlands offered an alternative to their original plan as yet? And if not, what's Wild Stand's next move going to be?
Well, it's a good question, and it's sort of an open-ended question at this point. The way that things stand right now is that Island Timberlands have agreed to meet with the Cortez community this week, and more specifically, their lawyers are meeting with the legal team that we've retained for the purpose of negotiating this. And so we're sort of going to need to see where that goes to begin with. But the community members that are organizing around this issue are continuing to put their efforts into, you know, preparing for the potential that we may need to protest and to blockade again. And we've been engaging our networks around the world, and there's been a huge influx of support, especially on our Facebook page and through email. And so we're kind of getting up to speed on a number of levels to sort of prepare for what might come, and we're not really sure what that is at this point. So it may be that they apply for an injunction, and in which case we're going to need to have as much support as possible on the ground to oppose their equipment and machines coming in. And at the same time, there's some potential still that we could come to an amicable arrangement with Island Timberlands. I don't believe that the Islanders' request and wishes are unreasonable, so we're not opposing all logging on this land. We're just opposing the sort of standard industrial scale logging that they've proposed. And so, if Island Timberlands is willing to work with the community and come up with a forestry model that sort of meets our needs and that respects the integrity of the ecosystem as well as providing more sustained long-term local jobs, then, you know, maybe this will all end happily.
Well, has anybody from Island Timberlands come over to Cortez? Are they planning to, or is this a teleconferencing, a kind of consultation? And if they're consulting, are they consulting with Wild Stands or with some other party, governmental or otherwise?
Yeah, they have been to Cortez a number of times. This has actually been running for about 4.5 years at this point. So over the course of that time, they've shown up on Cortez in various capacities. They've had some community meetings. They've had some closed-door meetings with members of the community. They've also done some walks through their lands with members of the community, and they've invited us into their office at times to meet with them. So there has been some dialogue over the past 4.5 years, but it really hasn't resulted in anything that looks like a resolution to the Cortez community. So what they came forward with over the course of the last year were some minor adjustments to their original logging plans, and they were adjustments that just really didn't meet the demands of the Cortez community. So that's why we're in the position that we're in now. So we really haven't seen the willingness on their part to work with the community that we would like to see. And the community members on Cortez are really open and really willing to work something out that kind of benefits all parties. It's just that we need to see that our island ecosystem isn't destroyed in the process, and that we can look at a model that provides more local jobs for a longer term. The sense on the island is that is not in opposition to logging across the board. You know, there's a lot of people that feel really strongly that it's an important part of the provincial economy, and that, you know, it's a big source of jobs locally. But the reality is that Island Timberlands ships the majority of its logs raw overseas, and so they're not necessarily going out of their way to support local jobs either on Cortez or provincially, and that's a problem for the island community. The other problem is that there's really no adequate regulation on forestry operations on private land. So that's something that we'd really like to see addressed on a wider level, on a provincial level, and Cortez is, you know, the perfect place for that to get started. We've got a number of folks on the island who are really experienced experts in community forestry and forestry that sort of takes into account the long-term plan for the land, and, you know, folks are really willing to kind of set their minds to how we can make that work with Island Timberlands and build something with them that everybody benefits from, that, you know, they can still bring a profit, but that doesn't necessarily leave all the cost of the logging riding on the shoulders of the island community.
Well, now, Zoe, when you mentioned the island community, first of all, can you tell us a little bit about Cortez? How many people live there, and what's the nature of life on the island?
Yeah, Cortez is a beautiful little island in the Desolation Sound. There's about 1,000 year-round residents there, and like a lot of the islands in the area, that population goes up quite a bit in the summer. There are a number of folks who have summer homes on the island and who winter elsewhere. It's a pretty popular place for folks who are looking for sort of an alternative lifestyle but who can't necessarily afford to live on the island year-round. And it is challenging to make a lifestyle on the island year-round. The local economy is strong in some ways and not so strong in other ways. So there's a lot of young families that struggle on the island, and that's where a community forestry operation, you know, with value added, could really benefit the local community and could really contribute to, you know, a thriving community and lifestyle and way of living on the island. So it's sort of been a dream locally to have something like this where we can partner and look at a model that benefits everyone. I think it would be a really positive thing for the local community. It's just that there's been very, very little to no willingness on the part of the corporation to look at doing something like that with the community. Like I said, they did make a few small adjustments to their plans, but they weren't adjustments along the lines of, you know, actually working to build something together.
And when they talk to you, who does Island Timberlands talk to? I mean, when you mention the community, is it Wildstands as a representative of the island community, or is there another group or organization that's talking on the behalf of the whole island? And is there a sense of consensus on this issue that nobody on Cortez wants to see the Island Timberlands plan as it's presented so far go ahead, or are there people that want to see Island Timberlands come and clear cut?
Yeah, I mean, for sure, like within any community, there's some difference of opinion. And there are a few people that would stand to profit from IT's logging plans as is. There's been a few people locally who have been employed to carry out some of their operations there. But it's very few people, and the jobs are quite limited and short term. So the general sense on the island is that another alternative or another model would be preferable. Like I said, there's some difference of opinion on that, but the kind of bottom line is that there's a really strong concern on the island for the ecological impact of the logging, as well as for the fact that, you know, we'd be missing a huge opportunity for an economic boost and, you know, potentially sort of setting a precedent for these kind of operations in other small communities that might actually move us forward and move us out of this sort of cycle of clear-cut logging and devastation of the land and, you know, maybe a small boom in local jobs, but then sort of a local economic depression that follows. So that's a pretty big concern across the island. And our local regional director on Cortez has been following the story, as well as has our MLA, and they're both quite engaged around the desires and the needs of the community members. And so there's been some communication, particularly from our regional director, who, you know, politically represents Cortez Island. So she's met with Island Timberlands on several occasions and has, you know, been in touch with them fairly consistently throughout her two terms in office. And then beyond that, there have been sort of unofficially and not representing the community as a whole, but individual community members who have approached Island Timberlands and have had meetings and group meetings with them. IT, like I said, has come and met with the community as a whole in sort of a town hall style meeting that's open to the public. So that form of communication has happened. Wildstands has communicated with Island Timberlands, but just to be really clear that Wildstands does not represent the Cortez community. Wildstands is a group of concerned community members and is sort of an alliance of initiatives that are working concurrently to try and find a solution to this issue. So there's been, there's been kind of communication on a number of levels, and it's been really interesting to see how Island Timberlands has responded to that. So they've expressed a desire to have maybe a small group or one person to try and direct their communication through. And that really doesn't serve the needs of the community, which is, like I said, a diverse group. And there really isn't any one person who can, or even one group, who can accurately represent the, you know, the diversity of opinions of folks on the island. So, I mean, our regional director is kind of the closest thing that we have for that, but she can't really act as an advocate for opposition to the logging just because of the nature of her position. So she can represent the needs and desires of the community members, but her involvement can only go so far, of course, as sort of an official elected representative. So at this point, Island Timberlands, like I said, their lawyers are meeting with lawyers, and that's kind of where the negotiations are happening right now. So the lawyers have been retained. It's a firm here in Vancouver, and they're sort of representing generally the stakeholders in the lands that IT owns. So that includes, you know, any folks who have water licenses, anyone who depends on the water table on the island, which is everyone really, and anyone who has neighboring land, any of IT's holdings, which are extensive. And so there's a number of people who do have property bordering IT's lands that would be directly affected by their logging. So that's kind of where the majority of the communication is happening at this point in the process. And then beyond that, I mean, obviously when Island Timberlands employees show up to log and they're met with a blockade, there's direct communication that way. But those tend to be their contractors more than IT management itself.
IT Island Timberlands, of course. Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria, cfuv.uvic.ca on the internet around the world. I'm speaking tonight with Zoe Miles, and Zoe is a Cortez Island-raised activist, and she's a spokesperson for Wild Stands, the coalition group that is resisting the Island Timberlands move to begin clear-cut logging on Cortez. Zoe, you said that this has been going on for some number of years now. I recall reporting on this when Island Timberlands first moved on to the island and made this announcement that what they were going to do. If I remember rightly, there was some talk about what would happen to the land after they logged, and if this would be another case of a timber company going in, clear cutting, and then becoming a real estate company. Is this a fear on Cortez?
Absolutely, yeah, that's a huge fear on the island, and sort of. Sort of an assumption based on Island Timberlands' activity in other communities. So that's quite typical of logging companies, is to clear cut or skim off at least the best timber, which tends to be the older trees and the old growth stands. And then once they've sort of taken everything that's going to be of financial benefit to them and their shareholders, then flip the land and sell it as real estate and therefore increase their profit margin.
Now I see.
So the interesting thing, though, about Cortez is that because of the nature of our regional plan, any rezoning of land has to go through a community consultation process and be approved by the community. And realistically, that's just not going to happen on Cortez. The Cortez community is never going to agree to rezoning of the Island Timberlands holdings out of forestry and into either residential or commercial or whatever they might want to rezone it to in order that they'd be able to subdivide it into smaller parcels and increase their profit margin. But having said that, they could certainly sell off their quarter sections and just leave them as forestry-zoned land and still make a profit on it. So that's a huge concern on the island and would be sort of the epitome of disrespect to the island community, to be honest. I mean, not only not to hear our concerns and not meet us with a willingness to to try and come to an agreement that they can both make a profit and look good and, you know, help serve our needs, but then to take it even a step further and sell the land off as real estate would be sort of the ultimate insult to the island community and would really serve as, you know, a pretty big warning to anyone else that any other community that ever deals with island timberlands. And they do like to say that they do a thorough community consultation process. And they like to, I mean, the first meeting when they first came to Cortez to meet with us about this issue, they were telling us that they were really proud of their track record in terms of, you know, community consultation and satisfying the needs of the communities that they're working in and around. And we really haven't seen that play out at all on Cortez, so I wonder how much that is just, you know, what they like to say in their sort of PR piece. But certainly if they sold their land on Cortez as real estate, that would be a pretty clear case of, you know, their actions being totally disconnected with their words.
Well, Zoe, what's the provenance of the land that they hold? How did Island Timberlands come into possession of this land? And has there been any efforts of a land conservancy sort to buy these old growth stands to preserve in perpetuity?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good question. Well, it's sort of two questions in there. The first is sort of how IT ended up with these lands is a really interesting and sort of disturbing story. So they would have originally been Crown lands that would have been moved into private land designation during, I don't remember what decade it was, but it was a while back, and it was during when the Homesteading Act was active, and so they would have been moved into private land in order to be able to be sold to individuals at, you know, a reasonable price so that folks could come and settle the land and develop. And a lot of the pieces that were granted in homesteading grants ended up defaulting back to the province either because people didn't fulfill their requirements to receive the land or they weren't able to pay their land taxes. So the province ended up getting back a lot of forestry land, and then since it was no longer in Crown designation, was in private designation, the province was able to sell it off really cheap to logging companies. So it would have originally been McMillan Bloedel land that then would have been passed to Weyerhaeuser and from them to Island Timberlands. So IT's had it for a few years now, but kind of inherited it through this sort of this shady operation on the part of the province. And, you know, didn't necessarily pay, like the price for the land wasn't necessarily related to actual land values at the time. So That's kind of how IT came into possession of it. And sorry, again, your second question.
And, well, has anybody offered to buy this land to right. conserve it?
Yes. There have been a couple parcels that there's been interest. One turned to Whaletown Commons. The regional district actually wanted to buy from Island Timberlands, and they met and had sort of extensive negotiations about that, and Island Timberlands ended up withdrawing their willingness to sell that land to the regional district, even though the regional district had all the funds and, you know, was prepared to make a purchase from IT. There was some disagreement over the assessed value of the land. And therefore the purchase didn't go through, so Island Timberlands wanted more than what the assessed market value had been for the land, which
and
is how much the regional district was prepared to pay for it, obviously.
Well, I can guarantee you that it was a lot more money than they paid the provincial government to get it in the first place. Zoe Miles, there's probably a ton more we could go into, but we're out of time right now. How quickly do people contact or get more up to speed on this issue and find wild stands as well?
A couple ways that people can find out more information and get involved. One is on the Wild Stands Facebook page, which is just Wild Stands, all one word. People can also go to our website, which is wildstands.wordpress.com. And there's a place there where folks can join our email list, and we send out pretty frequent updates at this point. Also, folks can email me directly if they're interested or have any questions, and my email is wildstands.press@gmail.com.
Well, Zoe Miles, I have a feeling that you're going to be in for a very interesting couple of weeks, and I wish you all the luck.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, keep us posted.
It's been interesting so far.
Well, keep up the good work, eh, Zoe? Well, and thanks a lot for coming on.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right. Bye-bye. Now, I'm going to take a brief break, and when I come back, I'll be joined by Janine, and she's going to bring us up to speed with some of the things going on a little bit closer to home, so do stick around. And welcome back to Guerrilla Radio, CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria, cfuv.uvic.ca on the interweb, everywhere else. Joining me now, as oft times she does, is the publisher of the Victoria Street News and CFUV radio broadcaster in her own right, Janine Bancroft. Hey, Janine.
Chris, this morning at 7:30 this morning, somewhere in East Texas, two brave young fellas locked themselves between two barrels of concrete inside one of the Keystone XL pipelines.
Yikes.
Guess how long they lasted in there.
I don't know. That doesn't sound very comfortable, though.
No, well, they were prepared. I mean, they were prepared to stay there, and they had another woman who was helping them out by bringing them whatever they needed. So the guys who showed up for work couldn't get to work because these guys were in the pipeline. And so the police came, and at 10:40 a.m., they threatened to blast them with tear gas and canine units.
That'll help.
And then threatened to lift the pipe and just dump them out, which, of course, would have killed them because they would have been crushed by one of the barrels of concrete.
So they assumed that these guys had the keys and just weren't doing it. When we know when people do this, they don't take the keys to the locks with them, generally.
Right, right, yeah. Yeah, so about 12:30, I guess they went in there, and it sounds like they just yanked on the chain, and the chain actually broke. The report came in later. So they managed to arrest them about 12:30, and then also the woman who was helping them. So three of them have been arrested. And an update from the one guy in prison says that the blockaders did not unlock voluntarily, that the police pulled so hard on the barrel that the chain on his wrist broke. He doesn't think his wrist is broken, but he is injured.
Yikes.
From that. So how about that, right? And they make reference to the Unist'ot'en camp so that, you know, the connecting the dots that they're fighting the same fight, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And also today is day five of the Houston hunger strike, where Gulf Coast activists with the tar sands blockade are going without food to demand that a company divest entirely from the Keystone pipeline. So they're gearing up next for a mass action camp in East Texas, January 3rd till 8th. So anybody's invited to go to that who's interested in participating. And the website is tarsandsblockade.org. So change your Cuba plans. There's no point in going to Cuba when you can lock yourself inside a pipeline, Chris.
Yeah, I'd much rather be there than in the land of the revolution on the beach drinking mojitos. But this still has to go to Obama. Before the election last year, he kind of punted on this issue and said there wouldn't be any determination until after the election. It goes to the Department of State and then goes to his desk for final approval. So that, it hasn't even been approved yet. But there was an interesting story on this a few days ago, and I'm pretty sure it was Democracy Now. Who else would carry it? But they were talking about the American candidate for the next their next head of state or Department of State is Susan Rice, and Susan Rice is currently at the UN. But then they find out that Not only is Susan Rice and her husband worth between 20 and 40 million. I mean, can people not count more clearly than that? I mean, they don't even know how many millions they have. But she's got like $5 or $6, I think, million dollars worth of investments in Keystone. And then she would be in a position to, you know, as the Secretary of State, she would be in the position to, you know, okay this deal or pass it on to the president. So there's a clear conflict of interest there amongst her many other criticisms of her and her work.
Yeah, that doesn't seem to stop them, this conflict of interest thing. They just seem to blunder right through it.
Why do you think I got into politics?
Oh, it's all messy, isn't it? Well, you got to hand it to these guys. I mean, that was pretty brave of them. Uh-huh. Locally, Kinder Morgan is around having these open houses. They're going to be in Nanaimo tomorrow. They're going to be in Victoria on Wednesday, 5 till 8. It's a drop-in at the Cedar Hill Recreation Center, and then in Colwood, 5 till 8, and Saniston, 1 till 3 on the 8th. Sorry, Colwood on the 6th, Saniston on the 8th. So this is an opportunity to go and talk to Kinder Morgan about what you think about their pipelines. I mean, we have to stand up and do something, if not blockade, lock ourselves inside pipelines. At least go to these hearings, I think, is important.
Well,
right?
Bryony Penn's got a great piece on this in the New Focus magazine, and she talks about Kinder Morgan, and I couldn't help but think, while I was talking to Zoe in the last segment, I mean, in Bryony's piece, she talks about Kinder Morgan and how their honchos, how out of touch they are. Like, they don't understand who the people in British Columbia are that are opposing this. They don't even understand why anybody would, it seems to me. I mean, you know, and it seems to me the same thing with the Island Timberlands. You know, don't they know that, like, Sephora Berman and Rex Wheeler and all, you know, these very prominent environmental leaders live on Cortez, you know? I mean, didn't they kind of figure this out, you know? But I don't know. It seems that they're going to go ahead. And she had some interesting things to say about these other meetings that have already happened in other places, these Kinder Morgan meetings. And she describes it, in their words, they describe it as a fax spill, where they go and they bombard these ignorant people in British Columbia with the real facts. And so then they'll naturally come around to seeing their way, you know?
Right. Well, I think they're building all those new prisons for us, aren't they? Isn't that the plan?
Well, you don't want empty prisons around. That would be a waste of money, wouldn't it?
No, you got to get the work camps going, get people jobs, right? Jobs. All right. So locally, also the transition people, you know, they're well aware of the concerns with oil and gas and that we need to move beyond. And so they're looking at all different ways of doing that. And tonight they're showing a film starting at 7:30. It's a British documentary called 97% Owned, and it shows about money and capitalism and the current social and economic crisis and how it all works. So that could be very fun and informative, and it's at Fernwood Community Association, 1923 Fernwood, there tonight at 7:30. It looks like it might be free or by donation. And they're also organizing, the transition people are, this Resilient Neighborhoods workshop, which is happening Tuesday, December 4th at the Burnside Gorge Community Center. So that's a chance to get together and talk about how we can organize communities. I got a notice from the extreme weather, from Janet, the extreme weather, you know, plan, project, whatever it is, where they put mats on floor. So I'm guessing we must be having high winds coming or big rains or something, because she really keeps an eye on the weather. So if people are outside and need a place to go, there's Rock Bay Landing and Sandy Merriman and the Salvation Army and other rain. And
yeah, I heard the weather's going to get pretty breezy tonight, if they're right. I think they said between 40 and 80 clicks.
So, you know, mats on floors, and all those places get paid by the government for everybody who's on a mat on the floor. So fill them up and keep those charities in business. Another option is out at Woodwind Farms. They have, you know, they got these tents. I don't know if you saw that, right? These three-bedroom tents from Disaster Aid Canada.
Oh, really?
And
no,
normally this is a group that brings these really high-quality, tough tents to, you know, places like Haiti or Occupy Sandy victims or, you know, Afghanistan or places where people are having disasters and need housing, but they've actually dropped two of them at Woodwind, so that's pretty cool. And Richard this afternoon said that they've also received two camper trailer donations, and they're anticipating another 10 tents. So they've got between, I think he said, 9 and 14 people, sort of, you know, a handful of people who are able to stay there at Woodwind Farms, which is just on the peninsula there. If you want kind of a permanent, more permanent place than a shelter mat now and then, that's another option. And they're looking for donations. They've found a philanthropist who will match donations dollar for dollar up to $150,000.
Holy smokes.
Until the end of the month. Yeah, so, you know, they're really doing good work out there. And they're also having a Christmas craft market all the way till the 22nd, Tuesdays through Saturdays. They're at 7789 West Saanich Road. I would recommend go out and check it out. He's taking in people who, you know, are clean and sober, and they're not forced to work on the farm, but that's an option. If, you know, if they feel like they want to participate in keeping the farm running, they can. They get fed, and they've got a place to live where they don't have to push their belongings around all day. There's a safe community there.
Well, I know it's been a long march for Richard out there, and we've had him on the show here. I can't even remember now when he was trying to get this thing going. It must be 5 years ago now, eh?
It's been a long time, and you start to sort of wonder what the heck is going on. But I have to say, I mean, I'm really impressed with this the Tent City thing, and he's, you know, he's managing to do it sort of under the radar in terms of he doesn't have official support from the municipality, but he's just going ahead with it because he sees the need. And to me, you know, I visited the Dignity Village in Portland a number of times, and to me, it's just the way to go is to allow people to have some independent living where it's not a charity. They're there and they have their own space, and they're able to get their crap together from that place.
Yeah, it's important. Okay, Janine, well, your program, Alternating Thursdays with Manny Najari's Hidden News, 11 a.m. right here at CFUV. The street news for December is out. The calendars are still selling like hotcakes, I'm expecting. Anything else?
Well, no, that's it for now. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, then, Janine, I'll talk to you the next time then, eh?
All right.
Now, I'm going to take another brief break, and when I come back, I'm going to be joined by Jim Miles, no relation to Zoe, and we're going to talk a little bit about another interesting issue, Canada at the United Nations. You'll be hearing a lot about this, I expect, in the coming weeks, so do stick around for that.
Netanyahu's in a tizzy. His eyes are filled with hate. He said the problem with those Arabs is they won't recognize a Jewish state. He said those Palestinians just won't come around to accepting Jewish rule on their holy ground. He said the Arabs don't accept their new neighbors in the hood. Those ungrateful regimes don't respect us as they should. Well, I don't want to upset anyone or unduly take to task, but if a state wants recognition, it seems reasonable to ask. Where are your borders? Where are your borders? Where are your borders? Where are your borders?
I heard him speaking to the Congress, getting his 29th standing O. He said, we need our security from those terrorists, don't you know? Well, if you want security, I wonder if you'd say it's true that the Palestinians should have security too. Cause if you want security, it seems only fair that you should also grant it to the people over there. And maybe you could answer, though the question is a sin, just where your country ends and your neighbor's lands begin.
Where are your borders? Where are your borders? Where are your borders? Where are your borders? In the Middle East? Or actually, he said the only viable one, at least. The PA isn't viable, because they didn't vote Abbas. They voted for those terrorists that they call Hamas. So we can't
recognize them, though we wish they would agree. Then we stole their land quite fairly here by the Mediterranean Sea. We stole it fair and square. We stole it just like you. If you don't like it, you're an anti-Semite, whether you're a Muslim or a Jew. Okay, right. But tell me, where are your borders? 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 Where are your borders?
And, of course, that's David Rovics. And David was here playing over the weekend, and he was kind enough to give me this disc. And this is from his latest, Meanwhile in Afghanistan, and it's in the works of entering our play rotation here up at the radio station as well. Well, last week, the United Nations General Assembly, in a historic vote, ratified the Palestinian Authority's application for recognition by that body as a, quote, non-voting observer, non-member state. Well, the motion was endorsed by an overwhelming majority, despite or maybe because of weeks of bluster and bullying by Israel's representatives and those of its nearest and dearest friends, Canada and the United States. In unprecedented fashion, Stephen Harper's new government of Canada called back to Ottawa senior diplomats from Israel, the West Bank, and most pointedly from the UN missions in New York and Geneva in a reaction to the domestic and international ridicule the government is receiving now. Canada's Foreign Affairs Minister, John Baird, went on the TV there assuring Canada's diplomats will return to their posts following some consultations on what future direction Canada will take in dealing with the region. While Jim Miles is a retired educator writing on politics and U.S. foreign policy and the environment, his articles and book reviews are published online at the Palestine Chronicle and my site, Pacific Free Press, amongst others. Miles covered the surprise Canadian government reaction to the UN move in his article, Congratulations, Palestine, from an embarrassed Canadian. Well, welcome to the program, Jim.
Thanks for inviting me.
Well, now, Jim, in your article, Congratulations, Palestine, from an Embarrassed Canadian, you write that John Baird, our Minister of Foreign Affairs, clipped a little bit the historical context of the Israeli-Palestine conflict in his speech to the UN, intimating that the issues are, quote, too intricate and too complex to be resolved by symbolic unilateral measures. Well, he's right. I'm confused. What's symbolic or unilateral about the UN's limited recognition of Palestine, Jim?
Well, lots, actually. There's tons of symbolism for it. There's symbolism on the personal level for the Palestinians. There's symbolism globally for its relevance to American power. There's symbolism for Abbas in the West Bank and how he got sort of caught between a rock and a hard place. There's sort of moral support. Maybe the governments of the world recognize that, hey, the people of the world are expressing their opinion. We better maybe at least give this symbolic gesture, whether there's a practical application after that or not. So I think there's a very strong symbolism to that. And if I remember my last line in the article, symbolism has a long history and it has a long memory. Whether anything actually comes from this, everybody may have voted that yes, we say that they can have observer status as a state, and then not follow it up with anything. But I have a feeling there might be a fair number of practical applications that come from this. And I can get into those in a moment if you want, but you mentioned a bit about unilateral. I have it's unilateral if you're looking at it from Israel's point of view, maybe. It may be unilateral if you're looking at it from the U.S. point of view. But on the other hand, the state of Israel itself was a unilateral state. They declared their independence. The U.S. declared their independence. They did it unilaterally. They didn't get a group of people. Well, in the States they did. They had a group of people. But again, it was unilateral against the British. As far as a unilateral action goes, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. And if you consider the U.N. vote, it turns out it wasn't really quite so unilateral because there's 138 countries that said, yeah, we support you anyway. So depending on your perspective, yes, it's unilateral or maybe not, but there's certainly nothing wrong with it being unilateral, although Netanyahu tried to play it down and make it sound like, oh, well, it's nothing really terribly important.
Yeah, well, I can't.
Does that answer your question?
Well, you know, somewhat. You know, I can't imagine. I can't think of a single country that went, you know, had citizens of what wasn't a country go around cap in hand to other neighbors and say, "Hey, can we get your permission to have a country?" You know, it sounds to me that you know, pretty much every country is unilaterally declared. So, you know, I mean, it's disingenuous at best. Now, Jim, what do you find embarrassing about Mr. Baird's behavior in the wake of the UN's activity?
Whenever you read the article, embarrassment was not the word I would use. I probably would have used the word disgusted. The thing about John Baird in particular was, I listened to him several times, and he sticks pretty much with conservative talking points. I once saw him on an interview with Al Jazeera, and the Al Jazeera person was giving him a fairly direct question. And John Baird kept coming back with the same response, I honestly can't remember the response at the moment, but the same response. And the Al Jazeera interviewer was very good. He kept coming back to him, coming back to the question, saying, "Well, you haven't answered my question." And I must admit, John Baird was very good about his conservative talking point. He just kept coming back to it and coming back to it. So when I saw him at the UN, he was going on about negotiations. Yes, okay, it said negotiations, and each time he goes through a resolution from the UN over the course of 70 years, he mentions it says negotiate, negotiate, negotiate. And it certainly does, but the resolutions always also carry an awful lot more than that. They're short. Anybody can go on to the website at the UN and read them. They take all of 5 minutes to read most of these resolutions. One of the very beginning ones said the Palestinians have a right of return. That's part of the resolution that has been carried forward. It also says that Israel must withdraw from lands that it's occupied, and this is after the 1967 war. That resolution has also been carried forward by other resolutions that have come at a later date. Another of the resolutions was that Jerusalem would be made an international city. That was in one of the earlier resolutions, and it too has been carried forward by all the following resolutions. When John Baird argues about, well, we've got to get this two-state solution and we have to negotiate, in my mind, he's basically arguing for the status quo, which there's been negotiations theoretically going on for 30 years or whatever, and probably 40 years, and in the duration of that time, Israel has been essentially using that as a cover just to build settlements and more settlements and more settlements. With the end result that at this point in time, there's hardly any contiguous land left for even to consider a two-state solution, which ultimately I believe would be the end point for the Israeli government, is that they have all the land under their control. In a sense, Israel is a unitary state at the moment. It's an militarized apartheid state, but it isn't a de facto unitary state. With several solutions, you can have a unitary state. You could have the two-state solution, which Baird is calling for, and most people are still calling for, although it's going to be difficult to do under the circumstances as they stand. There's also been talk of a binational state, where both sides have their sort of parallel systems. I'm not sure I could follow that too well or how practical it is. So when I listen to John Baird, it's just these points that go on and on, and it's very limited in perspective, and it only chooses the negotiation stance, which historically has proven to be not beneficial to anybody for securing peace.
Well, yeah, and Baird, in a statement, in an interview I watched with the CBC with Heather Hiscox, he quite slyly decided for himself and for the Palestinians where the capital of any new Palestine would be. He said that this unilateralism was no good, and the only way that Palestine could be given a state was if there was direct negotiations between Jerusalem and Ramallah. Now, of course, the Canadian government some years ago recognized Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, but now they've recognized, although nobody asked them to, Ramallah as the capital of any eventual Palestine. But, you know, I, as you say with the negotiations, there seemed to be a bit of a stall, and one analogy of this that I thought quite apt was it's like negotiating over a pizza over the sharing of a pizza while the other person is eating it, you know, and they just go, oh, yeah, keep talking, and they keep eating, you know. Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Gorilla Radio on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria, cfuv.uvic.ca on the internet, everywhere else. I'm speaking tonight with Jim Miles, and Jim is a retired educator writing on politics, U.S. foreign policy, and the environment. His articles and book reviews are published online at the Palestine Chronicle and at my site, pacificfreepress.com, amongst other places. And Miles has covered the surprised Canadian government reaction in his article, Congratulations, Palestine, from an Embarrassed Canadian. Now, I'm sorry, Jim. I think and I apologize to you listeners for the quality of the recording, but I read my retitling of your article. It's actually, with apologies from Canada, congratulations, Palestine. I inserted your embarrassed state myself, and I apologize. I'm embarrassed about that. Well, Jim, we've seen that. One thing that didn't come up at the UN and hasn't come up in anything that I've seen Mr. Baird speak on in the last little while, at least, is Israel's unilateral bombardment of Gaza and its continuing raids on various cities across the West Bank. The truce in Gaza was called, although it's being broken every day and people are being shot, bombed, and killed by Israel still. How does this fit into how does this context jive with the Canadian government's position?
It doesn't. If you look back on the history of Israel, there's a couple of narratives that are going on. One is the Israeli narrative, of course, but even that has changed a bit as more and more Israeli professional people in universities have looked at Israeli archives. If you try to trace back who bombed who first, you go all the way back, and there's been, I guess you could say there's been violence on either side. But when you look at it in an even more full context, you have to look at the fact that Israel has and always has had the predominance of power. They have the story, particularly in 1947-48, when they claimed that they were attacked by the Arab countries, and it was this small state barely surviving, and they're against all these militias of the Arab states. But the Israel at that time, and I've read the notice, it was anywhere between 40,000 and 60,000 well-armed and well-trained Israeli infantry people, and this is because of the British support they received in World War II. When the British left, they essentially took over the British bases and the British armaments and that. And they, in a sense, started the uprising of Palestine in 1947. This is before the UN partition plan and before their declaration of independence. I might have that wrong on the partition plan, but before they declared their independent state, and actually that was when the Arab countries did send their militias in. Before then, they had used this preponderance of violence and force to ethnically cleanse a lot of the Palestinian villages. But ever since then, the power of the Israeli state has actually been very strong. We have never been the military underdog in the region. The 1967 war, current histories, and if you read people, I just read a book by Nico Pled called Generalson, and his father was a famous general who fought in both those wars, the 47-48 war and the 67 war. And the general consensus was that in the 67 war, the Egyptians were not ready for war, the Syrians weren't ready for war, the Jordanians weren't ready for war, and according to his father, it was a preemptive war. So again, Israel had this military might. They used it in a preemptive, unilateral, there's that word again, they didn't ask anybody for this, about this. And from that time on, they've always had this power. It was about that time when they developed their first atomic bombs in that region. And again, I've read estimates, they now have somewhere between 200 to 400 atomic bombs. And militarily, again, they're pretty strong. All their equipment is supplied by themselves in part. But they receive $3 million a year in military and other aid from the United States, as well as the technological assistance and just the backing of the U.S. to support them. So when it comes to arguing about someone sending a missile this way, someone sending a missile that way, you have to look at the Israeli state as being, it's the strongest state. I guess the other, another aspect you could look at is as an occupied territory under the UN Charter, I believe it is, might be the Geneva Conventions. Under one of those, an occupied state has the right to resist. And again, there'll be a lot of Israeli arguments about, well, we don't consider them occupied, we consider it our land, but I think the general consensus globally is that it is occupied land, and they are resisting. Put it this way, not all of them are. I would say the vast majority of Palestinians, from what I have read, and this was reading a lot of books, a lot of stuff online, they're basically looking for peace. They're not looking to kill the Israeli people, the Jewish people. They're quite happy to have a peace settlement of some kind that would come soon, and but they've been negotiating for 30 years and nothing has come of it. There's no rocket attacks. They are just, I think, well, in a sense, they're almost symbolic themselves. If you go back to that word, symbolic, the ones from Gaza are very inaccurate, generally, and they don't really create a lot of damage because they are so inaccurate. I'm trying to come back to your original question here. I sort of wandered all around here. you were asking about what about all the stuff that Israel has sent to the direction of the Palestinians, and they do. It's an occupied country. Gaza itself has daily encounters at the fence border. Israel reserves 300 meters or more, 500 meters or more, what is essentially Gaza land. They say no one can go on that land for our security. And they're, you know, they're firing at farmers, they're firing at kids, they're lobbing shells, and the Gaza reaction is every now and then they will fire off a rocket or two off into the wilderness, as it were. So it's a completely unbalanced situation, which now brings me back to, you talk about negotiations. People say, well, let's have Israel and Palestine negotiate directly. But it's really hard when one side has all the power. They have the economic power. They have the military power. They control most of the land. They control the laws. They control the sea, the airspace. They control everything there. And it's really hard to negotiate under those circumstances. So for people like Baird and Harper to say, let's negotiate again face-to-face. They've been negotiating for 40 years, and nothing's come of it. So for me, I'm not totally sure. I don't have the answer. I don't really think I do. But continuing negotiations as they were will not work, I don't think.
Well, Jim, we're definitely in for interesting times here, too, and with this new designation, and there's worries about the International Criminal Court, and now because the newly recognized Palestine from entity to non-voting, non-member status does give it access to certain United Nations mechanisms, and one of them being the International Criminal Court. But we can't talk about that tonight, Jim, because we're right out of time. But thanks a lot, Jim Miles, for coming on the show. Apologies about the crummy telephone connection, and we'll have to talk again, eh?
Sounds good. Thanks for having me.
Okay, then. Thanks a lot, Jim Miles. And you can find his stuff, as I said, at the Palestine Chronicle and at my website, pacificfreepress.com, and also at my blog site, because I've had so much trouble over the last months with Pacific Free Press. I've been going more and more to guerrillaradioblog.blogspot.ca. There's a lot of interesting stuff there if you follow this kind of stuff, for lack of another word. And thanks a lot to Zoe Miles, no relation to Jim, of Wild Stands. Go and check out their activities over there on Cortez. Thanks, of course, to Janine and everybody up here that makes the show go week in and week out. I'll remind you to stay tuned for jazz with Arnold and Rhythmining, and batten down the hatches. It's going to be a breezy one tonight. And I'll play myself out again with David Rhodes from his new disc, Meanwhile in Afghanistan. Until next time.
They say he acted alone, but he's living in a country where the xenophobic right is the second biggest party, and he's living on a continent that is overrun with prime ministers who tell us multiculturalism is done. They brag of their traditions, they swell with Christian pride, for the civilization built on